This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, we're talking with Glenn Garvin. He writes for the Miami Herald. He's a longtime contributing editor to Reason and Reason.com. And he is also our resident television critic who has just come back from a major television conference in Miami where he lives. Glenn, thanks for joining us.
I hope that doesn't mean I'm not getting paid for this.
Yeah, obviously.
Thanks, great,
yeah.
But,
now,
yeah,
you know what?
Yeah,
we pay you in colonial greenbacks. So it's, you know, and we're going to give you, you know, the cash is making its way to your house now. We like to surprise guests. So, you know, they get a knock on the door while they're recording. It's very exciting. And Ed McMahon will hand you a wheelbarrow full of colonial greenbacks or Deutschmarks. You can pick your currency. So you went to what was the name of this conference and what is it about and what did you take away from it?
Well, the organization is called the National Association of Television Program Executives, NATPE. Everybody says it NATPE. And personally, I have never heard anyone say National Association of Television Program Executives. NATPE, we call it. So NATPE started out in 1963, and at that time, it was essentially its conventions were essentially sort of television flea markets, where local stations would go looking to buy Jeopardy or Wheel of Fortune. Or reruns of Gilligan's Island in order to program their non-primetime television day. It's evolved over the years until now it's this giant intergalactic, or at least intercontinental, marketplace for new television. So, I don't know, there were 35 different countries, I think, there yesterday, including countries that the average American may not think of as big TV producers, like Turkey. But actually, Turkey is one of the biggest exporters of, call them soap operas, call them telenovelas, but whatever those shows are, they're one of the biggest exporters in the world. They've had tremendous success. So there was a lot of deal making, but whenever you have industry executives gather, they also gossip and try to figure out what's going to happen next. And what was interesting to me, if you read journalism about television, you would probably think that the big streaming video outfits like Netflix are stepping back from the production of TV shows. Two of Netflix canceled two of its most spectacular shows. One called Sense8, and the other called it was a rap show, a show about the invention of rap music.
Mm-hmm.
These were both canceled, and that made a lot of the TV industry writers say, the whole streaming video experiment with weekly television series has died. That is not the attitude among TV executives. They think those shows got canceled because they cost too much money and brought in too few viewers. But the idea that streaming video is going to attack television remains in place. The sort of most gloom and doom thing from the perspective of television executives is if somebody like Netflix should successfully bid on the NFL, the NFL TV rights when they come up for sale in 2022. If they get them, that means literally nothing on television is safe from Netflix and Hulu and the rest of these companies, and it's just going to remake the entire landscape.
Oh, I was going to say, did they talk at all about how, you know, with something like sports, you know, ESPN, as you know, which was the cash cow for cable TV for a long time, is seeing falling ratings, you know, partly because it seems like sports are not as important to people as they were 10 or 15 years ago, but also like the NFL and Major League Baseball and the NBA are, you know, one of the things I've heard is that those leagues are like, hey, why aren't we our own distribution channel? And they're doing stuff to promote, you know, NFL.com or MLB.com, like a streaming service where you can get any football game or any baseball game or basketball game that you want, regardless of geography. Is that,
well,
because TV is like an aging infrastructure. Even cable now has been around for, you know, it's been ubiquitous for 40 years or 35 years. And are these guys like, are they sweating it? Not so much that content is going away, but that their role in, you know, kind of curating it or taking money as it goes through their pipes is kind of coming to an end.
Well, there are a lot of things combining to give ESPN a headache right now.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is the absolute plethora of sports on television right now. I mean, it's not just the NFL and the NBA and Major League Baseball. Practically every college football game in a major conference is now on TV. Same with basketball and even women's basketball. I watch Stanford women's basketball all the time. They're on 6-7 times a month.
I want to point out because this is it's a contractual thing with Glenn. He has to mention that he is a Stanford grad. He's very excited. So that's why you're watching Stanford women's basketball. Is that right?
That's right. I'm still paying off my college.
Okay. Yeah, but you're right. Yeah, there's so much. I mean, the college level stuff, and it's interesting because when people talk about, you know, the NFL ratings are down, I haven't seen anybody add up the addition of college football to overall. I mean, if you want to watch football, this is like, you know, you can watch something all the time, including, I think it's ESPN.
Right.
Like, they're rerunning on ESPN Classics. They're running, like, games from the, you know, 1992 season where it's like Michigan State versus Ohio in an October game. Like, who could be watching this? But the point is, it's out there.
Right. I've often wondered if you totaled the ratings for not just the NFL, but the Pac-12 network and the Big Ten network and the SEC network and the Longhorn network in Texas, adding in all these regional sports channels, if the audience for sports is not actually up rather than down. But it's like everything on television, the audience is splintering.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it used to be that if you couldn't pull, in the old three-channel universe, if a show couldn't pull 33% of the audience of people watching TV at any given moment, it was headed for extinction. Now, people would kill for a 33 share, as that would be called. It's inconceivable. It's impossible. Friends, in its finale, which had, I don't know, 50 million viewers, which is a truly eye-popping number. I don't think that amounted to a 33.
Yeah, I remember. I was going to say, I remember when Seinfeld was the number one show in America in like 97 or 98, one of its last years. The audience that it was pulling was smaller than any of the top 10 Nielsen shows from 1968 or something like that. You know,
yes.
So that, yeah, I mean, your share can stay huge, but the overall audience is much smaller, right?
Well, it's always funny to look up. There was a show called My Mother the Car back in the mid-60s about a dead person who was a dead
reincarnated
mother
as a car.
Reincarnated as a car. People always talk about this as one of the epic bombs in television history. Well, you know, it had 25, 26 million viewers a week.
Yeah.
It would be the number one show on television.
Well, for
numbers.
A long time.
Now, by a long shot.
Yeah, no, I know that for a long time. I don't know if this is still the case, but there was an episode of the Beverly Hillbillies, which, you know, was a giant hit in its day, but it was the biggest audience for a for like a regular episode, not a finale, not like, you know, the ending of The Fugitive or something, the two-part finale or whatever. And it was where Granny boxes a kangaroo because she thinks it's a possum, like an L.A. possum that's really big or something. But it had like a 50% share because word of mouth was like so gigantic, and the Beverly Hillbillies was like, you know, the top rated show. And it's kind of amazing. And well, you know, let's dilate on this a little bit, because you grew up in the 50s and 60s in New Mexico. So this was like you were very much a captive, as were anybody growing up and through the mid 80s, a captive to a kind of three channel or a three network world. You might get a couple of local channels. You might not even get all three of the broadcast networks. You know, do we lose something when you know that like everybody on Sunday night at 7 p.m. or something is watching The Wonderful World of Disney? You know, do we lose something by, you know, having that audience fragment and splinter?
There are plenty of idiot sociologists who will tell you that, yes, we do, and we lose the commonality of the body politic and blah, blah, blah. I think that's a lot of crap. I think the explosion of television material that started with cable in the 1980s has been a grand thing. What if you don't want to watch My Mother, the Car, The Rifleman, and Beverly Hillbillies? Those are
Big
your
Valley.
Three choices.
Yeah.
Big Valley. There. you know, there's a lot of talk in the TV industry right now of peak television. They say, well, there's too many shows on TV. That's about 500 scripted shows. We're not counting reality stuff mm-hmm. here, which can be produced for 10 cents. 500 shows to serve a country of, what, 350 million? That doesn't strike me as excess at all. It strikes me as television being driven more than ever by the viewers instead of the network suits, and I think that's a great thing.
Do you believe, as the premise of the Disney movie The Barefoot Executive laid out, that the network suits are essentially chimpanzees throwing darts at a billboard or at a board for shows?
There was a TV show in the early 2000s, lasted very briefly on ABC, called, 9:30 Eastern, 8:30 Central. That was the name of the actual name of the show. And it was a scathing workplace comedy about television. And one of its conceits was that a chimpanzee was setting the network schedule by throwing darts, and lo and behold, the network skyrockets in the ratings.
Right.
And you know, I guarantee you that if anybody experimented with that and it worked, Hollywood compensation would suddenly be in terms of bananas instead of dollars. they'll do anything. They'll try anything.
Right.
I think it's I think this is the golden age of television.
Mm-hmm.
Much more so than the sainted 1950s, where, by the way, almost nobody has seen any of those shows. Playhouse 90, you got to look long and hard to find existing video of any of that stuff. I'm sure.
Right.
Well, it may have been great. Let's put it that way. It may have been great, but who actually knows?
Right.
It's just something people say, really.
So, yeah, boxing, obviously, was like a real mainstay of like Friday and Saturday night TV programming. And, you know,
you know, you did, but forget boxing. I was talking to one of the program syndicators yesterday at NATPE. This guy actually has episodes of Celebrity Bowling.
Oh, wow.
1962 or 63, which, if you own a TV station, it's available. It's available.
Yeah.
And he says people buy it.
So what kind of celebrities? Is it like, you know, Martin Luther King and, I don't know, James Arness or something? Or, you know, did they get actual A-list or B-list celebrities for that?
Well, these things are all subject to argument. I did see one still from an episode with Sammy Davis Jr.
That's pretty great.
He was at least B-list, I guess.
Oh, yeah, for sure, for sure.
This guy was really fascinating. He also has episodes, and he was actively selling these yesterday. The Cisco Kid, which I think started in about 1950. Hopalong Cassidy, 1951 or 52, thereabouts. And think about it, these shows are largely, though not all, black and white. They have all kinds of political correctness problems. Hey, Cisco, you heard that about 100 times an episode.
And I'm assuming all of the Native Americans were played exclusively by Italians or Jewish actors.
Right, of course. And actually, some of these shows, like The Rifleman, had a lot of peaceful Indians who were being agitated to behave badly by white guy
I thought you were going to say Firewater, you know, a Firewater salesman around. Yeah.
No, there's some lines even I won't cross.
Well, you know, one of the things that you were mentioning with like Playhouse 90 and that type of stuff, you know, the quality programming of the day, you know, and at, you know, various points they would have like James Mason or Laurence Olivier doing a Shakespeare play or whatever. But, you know, part of it is that stuff, like a lot of live TV was not captured, or it was captured on really bad kind of video. But another part, like, when you talk about stuff like The Rifleman, Bonanza is big on, I think it's MeTV, and there's also like a Nostalgia Channel. But it does seem that dramas do not carry well in a way that like I Love Lucy or even Father Knows Best, like, you know, kind of vague, you know, soft comedies or something, do better. Is that true? I mean, like, in a way, you know, I remember growing up, and this was in the 70s and 80s, I guess, where everybody talked about Hill Street Blues or Saint Elsewhere as like quality TV. And like, I don't think you couldn't pay people to watch that shit now.
Well, the problem with a lot of those dramas in the mid to late 80s, television began to realize that one of the potential ways in which they had an advantage over movies was serialized stories. It used to be, you know, in the 1960s mostly, each episode of Bonanza was self-contained.
Right.
You turned on the show, you got the whole story. In the next 60 minutes, it ended, and you could go about your business without ever watching another episode of Bonanza, if that's how you felt about it. Hill Street Blues and L.A. Law and some of these other shows began long story arcs that carried 10, 12 episodes, maybe even through a whole season. And that is very difficult to sell in syndication because people's schedules are more erratic.
Mm-hmm.
You can't count on watching the next show the next day. So that hurt a lot. And sitcoms, of course, serialized somewhat too, but to a much greater degree, they remain self-contained.
Right.
You can watch The Big Bang Theory on TBS, and every episode pretty much carries itself. You don't have to watch, you know, 10 of them in a row. So there is a problem with dramas, but there didn't used to be. My heavens, Have Gun Will Travel, Gunsmoke. A lot of these shows did very well in syndication for a long time.
Yeah. And Gunsmoke for a long time, I don't know if it still is, but was the longest running drama, right, in TV history, or TV show series. I think The Simpsons
it was
now
the longest
is,
series. I think The Simpsons. Yeah. Simpsons has eclipsed it.
Yeah, which is amazing, isn't it?
It may still be the longest running drama.
So,
or in fact, the longest running anything that's not a cartoon or a political talk show.
Yeah. What was before we get to what you're excited about now? What do you have like a memory of the first TV series that you fell in love with, or you know, and this. is something that is odd for, I guess for all of us now, but especially anybody under the age of about 35 or maybe even 40, you know, that appointment television or that destination where you would make sure you planted yourself in front of the TV 5 minutes to let it warm up so that the picture was good and ready. And like you knew you were going to be there on, you know, Wednesday night or something at 8:30 to watch your favorite show. What do you have a first TV memory?
I do. The first two shows I remember being really appointment TV for me. I was probably, I don't know, 3-4 years old. One, of course, was the Mickey Mouse Club. But the other was, I absolutely was in love with a Western about the U.S. Cavalry called Boots and Saddles. And it disappeared in the late 50s, never to be seen again. I've since looked it up. It's interesting. It has no actors of any renown. Apparently, the scripts were pretty routine. The reference books on Westerns don't contain very much about it. But I'll tell you, I was nuts for it. I was just absolutely nuts for it. Loved it much more than Rin Tin Tin, by the way.
Ah, yeah. The show about the dog, right? What was Rin Tin Tin? Was that Civil War, or was that kind of contemporary America?
Well, there were Rin Tin Tin movies, and I'm not sure about their setting, but on TV, Rin Tin Tin was at a place out west called Fort Apache, and mainly the soldiers in the fort fought Indians,
right?
As was quite common in 1950s Westerns.
I had this odd moment of when my younger son was born. I used to get up early at like 5 o'clock or something to give him a feeding in the morning. And by accident, I found that TV Land, which was part of Nickelodeon at the time,
right,
was rerunning Mannix, which was, I believe it was a cop show with a private investigator, Joe Mannix, from like 68 to 73 or something like that. And I ended up watching the whole run of Mannix, you know, during this period, because it was on 5 nights a week, hour-long episodes. And Mannix, which I always remembered as this completely dull show. It's like I would go read books rather than watch TV. It was so boring, and it was like an adult show. But Joe Mannix ended up being – he was a failed race car driver who was a sexually irresistible private detective. And he was Armenian America, and there was a whole plot line about him going back and patching up his relationship with his father in the Central Valley of California, who was a grape grower. And it was this like repository of washed up Hollywood stars in the late, you know, so it'd be like, you know, people like Douglas Fairbanks Jr. or, you know, Lee Merriweather or whatever, like these odd people would show up. And it was kind of fascinating, though, to see that TV was much more complicated than in the old days than I recognized it as a kid.
My recollection of Mannix is that there was actually some rather clever dialogue to it. And the other thing was it was sort of racially progressive.
That's right. He had a black secretary.
Yeah. Right. Played by Gail Fisher. Her name was
Gail
Peggy.
Fisher as Peggy.
And
yeah.
And she was, of course, as in all these detective shows, she was much more than a secretary. She was like, you know, assistant detective or something. Always.
That's right. Yes.
Helping him get out of jams. I regarded that show pretty well when it was on in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah. There was an episode that was also great, and this had to, you know, because it was on like late 60s, early 70s, but there was an episode where Mannix he would like be accosted by thugs in almost every episode, but it was a bunch of beatniks in the late 60s who like shot him full of what appeared to be heroin. So he had like a weird drug trip, but it was like literally bongo playing beatniks. And it was, you know, just kind of great to like the beatniks lasted, you know, into the second Nixon administration on TV, which is, you know, they had a good run, you know. But
well, I was intimately familiar with beatniks from the character Maynard on the
right.
on Dobie
yeah,
Gillis.
Who was played by Bob Denver, who then gained great fame as Gilligan in Gilligan's Island. What excites you about TV? Like, did you see any shows? And if this was kind of, the conference you were at or the convention, it was more about selling older stuff for syndication. But were there new shows or what are you excited about? And I realize about this every, there are still new seasons, but it isn't the same as, I am like sounding like a total old timer here. But when TV Guide would have the special edition of the preview for like, here are all the new shows that are coming out. And, they would have a page biography of each show. It was exciting. We don't really have that, but we do have new seasons. What's new and exciting for you?
Well, the most buzz about new shows was not about American shows, many of which are sort of niche things. Hasbro has a, I don't know if it's a network or just a production house, but they do a lot of kids shows based on, this will shock you in its cynicism, based on toys made by Hasbro. So essentially, if they get these on the air, it's like a half-hour commercial for whatever toy robot or whatever Hasbro is. So I didn't see any American shows that that knocked my eyeballs out. There was a lot of buzz about a Brazilian telenovela that had what it's a little different than the average novella in that the characters are all in middle age and they're saying, the hell with this, I don't want to be an accountant anymore, I want to open a pastrami curing shop or something like that. And what makes it conceptually interesting, at least, is that these things don't end well. Following your dream is almost always a very bad idea in this show. It's called Edge of Desire. It was averaging 45 million viewers a night in Brazil. Now, that it may not translate at that level of viewership to other countries or other cultures, but if you can pull in even half of 45 million, that's big business now.
And is that is that in Portuguese or Spanish, or do they subtitle it or dub it? What do they do for foreign audiences?
They'll subtitle it. Mm-hmm. They were plugging the thing. Well, of course, there's not that many Portuguese speaking countries, so they were plugging the thing though to both Spanish and English producers. There's another, there's another thing that can happen, and that is they sell the format. A lot of people, when I've been talking with friends about what I was doing the past few days, I mentioned that there were three Korean production houses there, and they were, actively grabbing people by the collar and saying, look at our show, look at our show. And for some reason, that strikes people as funny. Korean television, who would want to watch that in the United States? Well, the answer is a lot of people are watching a Korean show on television right now and not knowing it. ABC has a show called The Good Doctor, and it's about a young autistic guy who is also a surgical savant. It's been one of the most successful shows this new season. It's a word for word copy of a Korean show of the same name.
Oh, wow. And that's interesting because there's a long history, of course, of American shows, both dramas and comedies, of ripping off English, British formats. But yeah, that's pretty fascinating. I didn't know that about, they'll take it from wherever they can, right?
Right. So what we could end up with, and actually I can imagine this pretty easily, we could have an Edge of Desire here in the United States with American actors and set in Louisville instead of Brasilia, and it might do very well. There was a Turkish show called Stiletto Vendetta.
I really hope that's not a that is not a you know, that's not a translation issue, right?
No, it's I think that's
is it a stiletto heel or is it a stiletto knife? I guess it could be used as both.
I believe the ambiguity is purposeful.
Oh, yeah,
and,
right, yeah.
It's about four women, her childhood friends. Things happen, they go their own ways. Three of them go their own way. The fourth, they pull some sort of elaborate prank on the fourth woman. She's horribly humiliated, and they come to believe she has killed herself and disappeared. But years later, when they're all successful and cool, she pops back up and is not happy about what happened to her. They kind of deliberately did not give us a whole lot of information about the show, but there seemed to be a lot of talk about that one also. Now, I got to tell you, my favorite. Well, I had two favorites. One is a South Korean show called "I Am Not a Robot," in which the hero is in love with what he believes to be a robot who's actually a real girl. The plot possibilities, it seems to me, are endless with a show like that.
I'm assuming that this is not like a Small Wonder reboot, so the kid is, the robot is of legal age, I hope.
Well, she would certainly appear to be of legal human age, but of course she was only built a year or two ago. So
oh, this,
I don't know.
Yeah, this could be a whole legal
cyborg law. Exactly. the other one, and this, you know, you hear people talk about guilty pleasures. I think this would be one of mine. This is a show in Great Britain called "Don't Tell the Bride." It's a reality show, and what happens is they pick out an engaged couple, and they give the groom secretly $20,000 to plan and carry out, you know, the couple's dream wedding. But the catch is, it's secret. The wife, the bride, does not know about this and cannot be consulted on anything. And of course, there's a big reveal at the end of each episode, and the highlight reel they were showing, women screaming and crying. The soundtrack seemed to consist largely of that that theme from Psycho, from the shower scene.
Yeah.
This seemed like not only, you know, bad television, but horrible run amok social engineering, and I have to say I'm all in favor of it coming to the United States.
Yeah, no, that does seem also like that. Yeah, I'm signing up for alerts when that hits the TV. What are shows that are in production that have been around for a while that you are particularly fond of? You know, like say, you know, in 2017, it's you know, we're just into the new year. What were the standouts for you, and what were the ones that you thought were going to hit bigger than they did?
I was a big fan. Now, I knew this wouldn't have a a big audience because of its circumstances. AT&T's Audience Channel, which is available only on AT&T UVerse and DirecTV, had a show called Mr. Mercedes. A lot of people are going to recognize that. It's Mr. Mercedes is a trilogy of books by Stephen King. They are not horror novels. They're kind of noir detective stories about a retired cop, you know, being taunted back into action by the serial killer that he let get away. It was produced by written and produced by David E. Kelley, who's done all those, you know, Boston Legal, and it was tremendous. It was tremendous. It was grim, seedy, suspenseful. The violence, unless you'd read the book, the books where it was sudden and horrifying. Great show, but it came with a very low ceiling in terms of numbers of viewers
What is the strategy behind if you're David E. Kelley, you know, somebody's buying your stuff, but I assume given you get more creative control, but a smaller audience. And like, why would AT&T, is it a premium, for their cable system? Yeah. I mean, it seems.
Essentially, get AT&T instead of Netflix and you'll get a lot of great stuff, including this tremendous show that you can't find anywhere else. I'm dubious about the economics of this. It seems to me it's like trying to sell a subscription to Reason Magazine by including a complete set of the Encyclopedia Britannica with each subscription. Not that anybody would want those anymore because you've got Wikipedia anyway. But
yeah.
The economics, I guess, are somebody else's problems. I just thought it was a great show, and they've already called for another season of it. There were three books in this series, so I guess they can do three seasons without much trouble.
Yeah.
So that was terrific. There was another show that was not widely watched on the FX channel called Taboo, which is about the black sheep of the family, a seagoing soldier of fortune who comes back to London after many years away. And he has been followed by ghosts, whether these are real or metaphorical is not very clear, of slave trading, mass slaughter, cannibalism. He's just been engaged in a number of horrendous activities. His involvement was more innocent than others. Very, very dark program and completely unpredictable, I found it. Apparently, people didn't like that too much. I thought it was great. The ratings were pretty low. The last one that I really liked, and this is, of course, not actually television. It's Netflix. But there was a documentary, a three-part documentary called Five Came Back, based on a book about Hollywood during World War II and how readily these people like John Ford turned themselves into absolutely indecent propagandists for the U.S. government. And not only did they engage in propaganda, which you might argue is, well, you know, it was a war against a terrible enemy and everybody had to do what they could. But these guys making these movies, like John Ford and George Stevens, wanted to be honored for it. So this is where the Oscar for Best Documentary comes from. It didn't exist until World War II. Then they not only got it installed as a category, but said there could be multiple winners. So in some years during the war, there were like four Oscars for Best Documentary. And the films they made were, even by the standards of propaganda, pretty notorious. They were racist. They were false. They staged fake combat sequences for them.
Yeah.
And this is in tremendous detail.
That is, I would love to learn that they actually like took soldiers out of like, you know, Omaha Beach. It's like, now you only get 100 soldiers because we need them to stage a fake landing over here.
This is exactly what happened. This is, you think you're making a funny exaggeration. This happened. There was at one point there was a Pentagon investigation, and they came back and said, this is outrageous. We're diverting resources to this crap, and it's really crap. We're embarrassed to have it shown on our behalf. One of the movies, Frank Capra, made a movie called Know Your Enemy - Japan. It was so incredibly racist that Douglas MacArthur would not let it be shown in the Pacific Theater of the War. and told the Pentagon, frankly, I think you ought to try and get it banned in the United States, too.
You know, though, this and this is kind of like a Philip K. Dick reading of Frank Capra's entire body of work. But
exactly.
There is that moment. There's, you know, there's like a 2-minute sequence, or if even, in It's a Wonderful Life, where you see Pottersville, like if Jimmy Stewart didn't exist, and Pottersville is just, it's all like whorehouses, saloons, and casinos. And I think that
looks like a lot more interesting.
That's what I mean. Is that like he wrapped everything, all of his work is like window dressing for that moment of a pure kind of free market libertarian laissez-faire world. So I forgive him everything. But yeah, I mean, that is, you know, it's weird with documentary in particular, and it's true of documentary photography, like going back to, you know, Matthew Brady and other Civil War people, as well as like what's his name, Robert Capa in the Spanish Civil War. Like almost every documentary photograph, and I'm sure most documentary films, with the exception of the, you know, Rodney King beating, like they're staged. You know, they get revealed to be fakes. It's you know, it's kind of a fascinating lineage in documentaries,
right?
Especially around war.
Go ahead.
Well, do you think, you know, one of the things when I look back at the 90s and a lot of TV, and, you know, it obviously cable could have been rolled out. And I know you've written about this, and people like Tom Hazlett at Reason have written about how cable was throttled by the networks because they were more powerful. But by the 90s, you know, most people had cable and they had this like radical proliferation of choices. There were a lot of TV shows in the 90s. You know, The Simpsons is one. Mystery Science Theater 3000 is another. South Park towards the end of the 90s. But where it's almost like television was teaching us how to watch TV. There were a lot of instances where characters in TV shows are watching TV. Beavis and Butthead, you know, watch videos and caustically, you know, critically regard what's on the screen. And they're teaching us almost how to become media critics, or suspicious and skeptical of what we see on TV. Do you think that's kind of, you know, that we are as a society, you know, we're more critically engaged with media? And this, you know, this comes in with, you know, in a weird way, Donald Trump is, you know, he is constantly attacking the media. He is constantly attacking truth claims from gatekeeper institutions. Are we, you know, are we better at it? Because the flip side of that is that people say, oh, now you can find, you know, this is kind of another argument about the fragmentation effect of contemporary media, that people can find their own truth. So, like, if you don't like what NBC is doing, you can go to Alex Jones, and you can, like, you know, whether it's a right wing or a left wing conspiracy freakazoid, you can find your bliss and just be in an echo chamber. Do you think, is that happening, or are we actually more critical of media? And that's why a lot of, you know, like why people are pissed at the media writ large.
Well, I think in some respects, we're going back to the future here. The concept of objectivity and even-handedness in reporting the news, it does not have a long history in the United States or anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
During the 18th and most of the 19th century, newspapers were just rankly partisan, and you couldn't possibly believe anything you read in any of them. You had if you really wanted to know what was going on, or even a semblance of what was going on, you had to read two or three because they were all so absurdly biased.
Mm-hmm.
And what changed this a little bit was when some newspapers in New York decided to pool their news gathering resources and circulate stories among themselves. This was the origins of the Associated Press.
Hmm.
And obviously, you know, a Republican newspaper in Cooperstown and a Democratic newspaper in Syracuse, we're not going to be able to use one another's copy if it was, you know, written in this partisan model. So they told everybody to cool it, try and, you know, leave out the insults, try and stick to the mm-hmm. facts. Don't you know, don't put your opinion in so much.
Hmm.
And that spread. But so we're only talking about, 140 years of this. Now we seem to be going back in the other direction. I had hoped, I am a believer, frankly, I think there's room for partisan publications. I've written for a long time for one of them, Reason Magazine.
Well, we're not partisan. We are ideological, but we're not, I don't think we're
okay,
partisan.
Okay, yeah. Ideological,
but point of view,
partisan, yeah, although,
perspectival. Yeah. Let's dress it up.
But I think on balance, it was better when newspapers tried, however imperfectly, to run things down the middle and not when you could pick up, you know, the New York Times, and it had not declared war on whoever was the sitting U.S. president at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I had hoped that maybe the fact-checking aspect of the internet would push us back towards that direction. Instead, it's been just the opposite, and everybody does seem to be looking for an echo chamber. So some people watch MSNBC, and some people watch Fox, mm-hmm. The more partisan the audience becomes, it sometimes seems to me, the more partisan the news presentation becomes. And I don't think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people disagree with me. You may disagree with me, as you often do. And
I will only do that
so
behind your
back.
I will do that behind your back, Glenn, so I would never do that to your face. But yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. Are there places, because, you know, in the larger kind of television ecosystem, like, obviously, people like, and I'm sure you are eloquent on this point, people like, you know, Walter Cronkite or Eric Severide, you know, who are, I mean, just awful in terms of like the fake presentation of like, oh, we're just telling you facts here or something like that. And we don't want to go back to that, but I agree that like it's really hard to watch, you know, MSNBC or Fox or even CNN in a lot of ways, because it just is a dull and uninteresting conversation, and they talk about everything in political or politicized terms. So, you know, when they have a Republican or a Democrat on, depending, you know, and they'll always have, you know, a Republican and a Democrat, and then they spout talking points. One of the things, and I'm curious how you feel about this, that seems to be missing, especially as late night becomes more politicized, and late night hasn't been interesting for a long time because, unlike, and you know, this is probably just a youthful reminiscences of shows like Mike Douglas or Dinah Shore or Merv Griffin or on PBS, Dick Cavett, where they would have guests come on and then the guests would talk among themselves. You don't really see that anymore. And I mean, you know, Mike Douglas famously had John and Yoko guest host for a week. It gets shown a lot on like VH1 Classics VH1 Classics. But, you know, they brought in like, you know, John brought on like Jerry Rubin. And, you know, and then Mike Douglas brought in a conservative judge, and they would actually have kind of like interesting, weird conversations across, you know, political and ideological lines. And it seems very, you know, now that we have an infinite amount of time and space on the television dial, which, you know, for those of you under 40, they're what you TVs used to have dials. But, you know, it doesn't seem to exist. Is that your sense, or where are the places that kind of cross chatter is happening, if at all?
No, I think it's I think you're exactly right. And even the, you know, I can actually get really irritated in discussing this. You used to have shows like Crossfire on
CNN.
CNN, and they did what they did is they perverted the use of a broad ideological spectrum, mm-hmm. by encouraging the people to scream at each other and talk over each other and use, you know, stupid sloganeering as opposed to, you know, real discussions of what was actually happening. Who was it? Tucker Carlson,
mm-hmm.
I think
he was one of the hosts.
It was John Stewart. Who
John
said
Stewart
Tucker
attacked.
Carlson.
Yeah, he attacked Tucker Carlson.
You guys have ruined everything. I don't know that Tucker Carlson personally should be held responsible for that, but in terms of Crossfire, there was a lot of accuracy in that. That was a very corrosive show.
And that did kind of pioneer the sound bite. It was 30 minutes and it was like, okay, we're going to have a Democratic shill and a Republican shill, as if that exhausts the political spectrum, and they're going to yell at each other. And then like Bob Novak and Pat Buchanan and Tucker Carlson were on the right. And then it was Michael Kinsley, I think, for a while. And who was the guy whose story became the TV show, the terrible show, Eight is Enough? Was Pat somebody from like the Sacramento Bee, right? I think I'm tripping right now. I'm falling down into a, some kind of morass of La Brea tar pits of shitty TV. But yeah.
Well, that's, you know, the closest you can get to that kind of thing now is the Sunday morning Meet the Press type shows. Mm-hmm. And my girlfriend likes the one on CBS, so that's mostly what I've watched.
Uh-huh. Face the Nation.
That you can actually be at least moderately enlightened by watching that. They don't outlaw conflict, but you know the moderator is not giving brownie points for calling the other guy an asshole. But that's you're talking about a total of four hours a week spread across the big four networks there. It's a much reduced space for intelligent political discussion.
And I guess
it's very sad.
Do they have, and the network still, do you know offhand, like what is the magnitude of difference between say Fox News Channel, they're like, somebody like O'Reilly or something, and then a show that is on PBS or NBC or ABC, like, Meet the Press or Face the Nation or This Week. I assume that those Sunday morning shows on the networks, even though, kind of all of the energy is with cable, but I'm assuming that the networks still draw, three, four, five times as many viewers.
Two or three times as many, mm-hmm. Perhaps. Some of the Fox News in particular, some of its primetime programming draws kind of impressive audiences. We're still talking about, 4 million viewers and not 40.
Right.
But I think probably Bill O'Reilly, when he was on, was probably beating some of those Meet the Press type shows on the networks.
Yeah, and I know there.
It's hard to say that just as simply as that. You're talking about weeknight prime time versus Sunday morning,
right?
10 a.m. or whatever. But it
was fascinating. I know at various points when you see these crossovers where cable programming at various points, I believe in aggregate draws more eyeballs than network programming in primetime now, but it's split among many more shows. There was a moment where The Sopranos for a while was winning its time slot on HBO on Sunday nights, which, so a pay service that is, relatively small compared to, certainly network audiences, but was winning, that's kind of fascinating. And this is the fragmentation effect, which thankfully we don't hear so much about anymore. Like, in the 90s and in the early 2000s, there was a lot of whining and moaning, I think, among the elites that we were losing something by, not having a shitty TV show we could talk about, at the water cooler on Monday morning or something. But
really think about that. I love The Sopranos. It's a great groundbreaking show, sliced and diced a lot of things about American culture and American politics. But no way I would suggest that's a general interest show. I mean, it was bloody. It was sexually outré or whatever that word is. It was not family viewing. It would be insane to think that The Sopranos could have been a shared experience among 30 or 40 or 50 million people. Does that mean that it shouldn't exist at all for the 12 or 13 million who really liked it? That's ridiculous.
And it's, you know, what is
sociologists as a class should be tortured and killed.
I think we're going to have to leave it there. When Glenn, also in his contract, you know, being paid to speak to reason, he insists that after he calls for an entire eradication, I mean, the first mention of eliminationist rhetoric, which I think you just did, that's when the interview ends. So we happen.
If I stopped at torture, would it have been okay?
Yeah, work camps. You know, because you know, you could have really just dialed it back, and we could keep talking for hours. It is great talking to you both about the history of TV and media more generally, as well as news gathering. You have a long history as a journalist, as a print journalist, as well as being online and, you know, TV reviewing and whatnot. So it's been a real pleasure. This has been the Reason Podcast. We've been talking with Glenn Garvin. He is a reporter or a journalist at the Miami Herald, a longtime contributing editor to Reason, and our resident TV critic. Glenn, thanks so much for talking to us.
It was fun.
This has been the Reason Podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.